Hi, welcome to today's episode of The Language Lounge. My name is Michelle Ola, and in this episode, I talk with Alyssa Farias about how teachers can use high-impact strategies to maximize student language learning after what we can all agree has been an unprecedented time in education. We talk about some of the high-leverage teaching practices that research shows has a high effect on student learning. And we also talk about some that you might be surprised have little or no effect on student growth. We hope to connect some of the high leverage teaching practices of general education to second language acquisition and effective language instruction. So grab a cup of coffee as we talk research and what it looks like in our language classrooms. All right. So hello, Alyssa. I have my friend here today, Alyssa Farias, and we are going to have a conversation about a lot of things, rigor, stamina, high yield practices and strategies. We've got a whole bunch on our minds today about this, right? So I'm just going to hop in. And Alyssa, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and why this is on your mind?
Sure. Well, I'm currently an assistant principal, elementary level, at a dual language Spanish-English school. We have one class per grade level that's Spanish-English dual language, just to be clear, the whole building's not. Prior to that, I was a high school Spanish teacher and loved what I did it for 10 years. In between both those positions, I was a data coach, so random, throws people off, but I was. The reason why these topics are important to me is because when I entered education, I had a very traditional mindset of what education is because of how I received my education growing up. But then I got a job, first job teaching, the only place I taught, same classroom, all 10 years. They had a very different view in education. And it was, we got to get these kids the most out of life. And it's our job to do that, to provide this for them, to provide rigor, to believe that they can achieve above and beyond anything they could ever imagine, acceleration, you name it. And that was the environment I was in. And we saw amazing success in the program, not only with my world language students, but students in our whole building. And the success is still sustainable. So for me, it's not just I believe these things to be true because they're words that get thrown around in education a lot. It's because I experienced it firsthand. I know it's possible, and it's still possible even as we return back to pretty much everyone being back in the classroom in this fall.
Awesome. And, you know, I think everything we talk about is important and always important. Like you said, like these are some really important strategies and mindset and all of that, but especially now, right? And even though it feels like a huge mountain to climb, I think now more than ever, we need to focus on that, like you said, increased rigor and stamina and some of these things like that, right? One of the things that I know I hear and I try and combat every time I hear it is when we talk about reteaching, remediation with, you know, all of the things that were lost in the last year and a half, right? And I know we talked earlier about focusing on acceleration over remediation. So tell me a little bit about what does that mean?
Sure. The mindset currently is, oh, we got to catch all the kids up. Well, most of our kids are already behind. That's the reality of the situation we're in pre-pandemic, right? And so trying to catch them up from being far behind from the pandemic is just like a relay race that's never going to end, right? And so it's really like, when do we actually begin to just dive into the race and just be there and stay there and move forward? And so really it comes down to what is rigor? What are high levels of expectations we have for our kids? What do those really mean in practice to actually be actively running the race? It's like, I use this analogy all the time when people are like, we need more interventions. And I go, interventions only pull kids out of the race. When are they ever going to be in the race? That's where they need to be. And that's where they need to stay so we can get them there, which seems crazy because then you're thinking, but they don't have maybe like the skills to jump the hurdles like we need them to be in the race. But no, you actually can if you teach them how to jump the hurdles the right way and kind of throw out some of this other stuff we're doing that doesn't actually make sense and takes up space in the learning environment.
Absolutely. Laser focus, right? And really doubling down on both the content that's necessary. Mm-hmm. And again, we think, oh, well, it's all necessary, right? Mm-hmm. But I think over the last year and a half, whatever it's been, I don't even know, I've lost track, yeah. right? I think we've really realized, like, no, there's a lot of stuff that is not necessary, right? Yes. So it's mm-hmm. pulling that content, and we're going to talk about really using strategies that are uber effective, right? Mm-hmm. That we know that research shows. So let's do a little primer on one of the things we were going to talk about, and those are some high yield strategies.
Yeah.
You know, there's some people like John Hattie and effect size, and a lot of, I can hear teachers all over going, no, but it really is good stuff. There is mm-hmm. a lot that we can learn, not just general education teachers, but as world language teachers, yeah. right? So tell me a little bit about your experience. I know we've talked about John Hattie and visible learning. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about those, him and the practice of those high yield strategies.
Sure. So John Hattie is a researcher, and he took 1,200 different studies and figured out what yielded the highest impact on student learning, and then compiled those into a list. And it didn't originally start with 1,200. It originally started with like 800, and he's built it up over time. So what he's saying is, here's what people are doing all over the world to educate kids, but here's the actual things that actually show growth. And what we mean by high yield is that there's a lot of things we do in the classroom that will yield growth. There's some things that will yield a high amount of growth. And there's some things that if we do or don't do, it doesn't matter. Kids will still grow no matter what. Like my child, no matter what I feed her, she's still going to keep growing taller, and I'm going to keep having to buy new shoes. So some of the things we do isn't going to impede the fact that kids will grow. But there's some choices we can make which will yield higher growth. And he ranked them. And they're on this effect size. How big of an effect do they have on the student? So anything that actually has a 0.4 or higher means that that actually yields a year plus growth. So I'm going to say that again, yields a year plus growth. And what that means is the child will grow a year like they should plus more. And those are the things that we need to look at doing in the classroom and getting rid of all the other stuff that's not yielding that much growth, because then we're not going to be in the acceleration zone. We're going to be in the behind, I guess you could say, the traditional mindset, not the acceleration, more remediation. And there's makes no sense to do that. If research is telling us it does not impact students in a high yield strategy, we should throw them out, especially considering how much we got to do for kids right now. Oh.
Absolutely. So what are some of the maybe surprising or some of the highest effect size strategies that, you know, we all know and we may or may not buy into? So what are some of them that we really need to be digging into?
Sure. And I'm going to relate them straight to like what you would imagine in a world language classroom, because when I began. Perfect. Okay. When I began learning about the high yield strategies, I thought, well, how does this fit into my classroom as a Spanish teacher? I taught all grades from first year Spanish to heritage to AP, you name it, everything you could imagine in high school, I taught it. And so I began then converting these strategies into the classroom. So one of them that's a very high yield is that you work together with students with a clear success criteria. The kids know exactly where they're headed. So right away, if you simply just have a learning target on that board and a success criteria, the kids know where they're headed. They're not blind. You're not just leading them. And they're just like sheep following. They're right along with you on that race. And they know what hurdle's coming. They know what sprint they have to do. And they know kind of where the end goal is. And beyond that, they know after this sprint, here's my next level, the next thing I need to achieve. When we think about that, a lot of times in classrooms, teachers will think, okay, so I need to have my kids know the vocab list for fruit and vegetables. Nah, but that's not language acquisition, right? It's actually their growth in their language ability that they need to understand.
Absolutely. Those proficiency, performance targets, can-do statements, all of the things that we know help language acquisition mm-hmm. also are working on this high yield strategy, right? So yep. I know when I was in the district office in my county here, and I would talk to teachers, and we were like uber into Marzano and learning goals and scales and all of this stuff. And there's a lot of compliance, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of, but I teach a language and this doesn't apply to me, right? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the best practices and the high leverage teaching practices for our profession really do align with a lot of these things, right? Mm-hmm. And so having those clear goals and expectations, having students know what they're going to do, what performance assessment they're going to do at the end, mm-hmm. How you're going to get them there. All of those things are extremely important for both the student. Yep. And I would also argue for the teacher, right?
Oh, yeah. Because
if we don't have those kind of that path as yep. well, we can get lost in the weeds and kind of not be as effective as we might hope to be as well.
I totally agree. In fact, I took it to the level where the back wall of my classroom was the proficiency levels. And so we're all on the same page. When I say proficiency levels, I'm talking the actual proficiency, sometimes called performance levels, where we start at like a novice learner and intermediate. I only had novice to intermediate on my back wall. And then I broke those down into novice low, mid, high, intermediate, low, mid, high. Because I knew on average, my kids are going to be lucky if they get to intermediate high by the end of AP. That's going to be a golden ticket. So that was simply the goals I set for them. And they were all big and a big pathway on my back wall.
Fantastic. And again, just that little thing, right? That both helps their language acquisition. It's very brain friendly and it's a high leverage teaching practice.
Yep.
Awesome. So what else is there besides the learning goals and really communicating those expectations along to students and with students of what what you intend for them to learn?
Sure. Another piece of it is once you have articulated to the kids, here's their proficiency levels, here's what each one means, here's what you should do at this level and what you should be able to do the next level, then you got to have them self-assess. We just simply forget that kids can self-assess. I will tell you, when I was a beginning teacher and I would be ranked, we use self-ID in my district. It was always the same thing my admin would say to me. But yet, did you have them self-assess at all? And I'd be like, shoot, I forgot again. I need to have them engage in their own learning and them tell me on the rubric, I'm a novice mid, but I need to do these two things to get to a novice high. Having them be part of their own grading, and I'll tell you, it actually saves teacher time because kids most often than not actually assess themselves pretty good.
Right.
And I did do a little check mark, thumbs up. Yep. I agree with you, buddy.
That's great. So teacher tip and high yield strategy. You can't beat that. Right. But you're right. I think sometimes we don't give them enough credit to be able to do that. I just talked actually to Greta Lungard about the gradual release of responsibility and how essential that self-reflection piece and students owning their own language and process and all of that really is. It all sorts of ties together, right? Awesome. So what else do we have on your list of some of the really high impact ones for education and for world languages?
Sure. One that jumps out to me as I'm kind of looking at my list over here would be feedback. Feedback is so huge. And when we think of feedback, it has to be very direct and targeted to that student. And that's why rubrics are fabulous, because you already have the rubric. You got your novice low, mid, high, what each one is. And all you got to do then is after the kid has self-assessed their own work on their own assessment, their own quiz, their own oral presentation, whatnot, you then simply can circle the things that they need to work on also and provide input. I know that AAPPL even has documents that will say, here's where you're at, here's what you need to do. I simply use those. And all I had to do for feedback was circle the exact thing that was in that bullet point for what they needed to do. But just telling my kid, you earned an 80%, that doesn't mean anything. I need them to know you were at a novice low, and here's the two things I need you to do moving forward. And that very direct feedback also supports them and them knowing what they're supposed to do next. It's that whole idea of don't let them be blind through the obstacle course of learning. They know the learning target. They know the success criteria. Get them to know what they need to do next. And that really supports them, that very direct, targeted feedback to the student.
Absolutely. And again, feedback, that's kind of something, you know, hey, good job, or, you know, way to go, is not feedback, right? That's coaching. It might be like a cheerleader sort of thing. But what we're talking is, you know, actionable steps that they can take to get to that next, the next level. And I agree. Feedback is fundamental. What do you know what the effect size for feedback is? I'm just curious.
I do actually. It's 0.7. And so what that means is that if 0.4 and higher has a year's plus growth, 0.7 is really, really, really stellar. And what I'll say is, I know teachers feel that there's takes so much time to provide feedback. Well, then pick and choose when you provide feedback, right? Pick a few kids a day, pick an assessment that you can provide feedback, and let kids give each other feedback. There is never anything wrong with having that rubric in front of them, especially if you use the AAPPL one that really ranks the novice and it breaks novice mid down even further, because it takes a kid can live a novice mid forever.
Yes.
But AAPPL breaks it apart. So then it feels like there's two levels within it. And right below it, it'll tell you, here is what you need to do. So I had my students provide feedback to other students. Sometimes they're more inclined to listen to their peers than the teacher. We think about Peanuts, the teacher in front of the class in the cartoon Peanuts, you know, like no one knows.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So kids can be part of the process, and that only links you back to clear success criteria. They too then know where they need to go.
Absolutely. And it is also motivational. The more they have control over their own learning, the more they are, you know, understanding the process. They're not just showing up and having their learning just happen to them. And they're part of that process, right?
Yeah.
And so again, all of these are both high yield strategies according to Hattie and the research in general education, but they're also part of those high leverage teaching practices for, you know, languages and, you know, specific as well. So wonderful. Any others that are big ones that you would want to mention?
I would say a huge, huge, huge one is a classroom discussion in a world language classroom. The more we get them talking in the target language, the more they're going to use it. There's definitely a silent period in the beginning, sure, where we're talking a lot more and they're listening. And I'll tell you, when I first understood the concept of input and output of language and how much input they have to receive from me and the audio I bring in, the content that I'm bringing in, you name it, and I'm going to get a little output from them, that blew my mind. So I transitioned my classroom into 100% Spanish. I never spoke English, even Spanish one, semester one, day one, it was Spanish from the get-go. And the more I could get them in classroom discussions, the better. And one of the things I learned, so here's a strategy. When we think of classroom discussions, it's not scripted. You need to try to be as spontaneous as possible. So one of the ways I was able to get my kids to reach this high yield strategy for classroom discussions is I would say to them, especially by second semester, first year, totally can happen. Ask a follow-up question, listen to what they say, and ask one more question. Because when you ask a follow-up question and the student replies, you're not expecting their answer. Now you have to listen and spontaneously come up with something else. I wanted them to actually have an unscripted discussion. Even if I gave them sentence stems, even if I gave them questions to pick from, they were still spontaneously trying to use the language. And that is really important, to have less script as possible when kids are using the target language.
Absolutely. You're teaching them those skills that they're going to need eventually, right? Life isn't scripted. If I'm talking to you, you don't know exactly what I'm going to say. You have to come up with something else. You know, we're going to work together. And so, you know, they might need more scaffolds in the beginning, right? And then as they have more language, they understand how this works, how this reciprocal kind of action works with a conversation. Yeah, there will be able to really, you know, get rid of some of those scaffolds. And pretty soon we're going to build them up to that. Awesome. I think that is, those are some good ones. What the fantastic. And, you know, here's the other thing. So you talked about setting expectations, those learning goals, clarity, all of these things that have a high effect size. Mm-hmm. What are some things that may surprise teachers that have little or no effect size, or it can even be negative, right?
Yeah. The one that always gets teachers is homework. Teachers believe without a doubt that homework impacts students, but it really doesn't. You're having a kid go home in an environment where most people are not going to be able to support them with their learning at all. And it becomes more repetitive practice than it becomes anything else. So it's not actually deeper level thinking. It's very surface level work that we send them home with because we recognize no one's there to do it. And we're also not acknowledging that all of our students have different classroom environments. Like I, as a single parent, when my kids come home and I get off work, get home by like five something, I'm cooking dinner, I'm packing lunches, I'm feeding them dinner, getting them settled. It's 6:30 at that point, and I don't want to dig out their homework folder. I don't. I just want to play with them and put them to bed, right?
Absolutely.
And so it's like it's ranked as a point, like 0.29. It's not yielding a high yield strategy. So you have to ask yourself, that might be one to let go of. And then you get frustrated because the kid doesn't do it. And then you're docking their grade.
Yeah, there's a whole lot to unpack there, right? I know
very
in
negative.
In one of the previous podcasts, we talked about that negative impact on a grade based on a home situation, perhaps it could be, or we give students practice and the ones that if they need practice, they need you to be there with them to do it. They're not able to do it on their own, or if they can do it on their own, they probably don't need to be practicing it. Right. So the first time I heard homework had that low of an effect size, it both surprised me and really kind of challenged my thinking so that if I am going to do something outside of class, I had better have a reason and I had better really know what that expectation is going to be, right?
Yeah.
So, and I know that as in elementary school, I had this debate with some of my son's teachers as well, that, you know, in elementary school and middle school in particular, it has definitely none and some, but very small in secondary. Is there anything else that has little or no that we might be doing out there that we might want to consider stopping?
A big one is actually how students feel in the classroom. It even has like a negative effect on their learning if they don't feel that they're liked by their peers and their teacher. And this is a real thing that happens every day for our students. I mean, as a classroom teacher, I've had students who just push my button, push my button, push my button, right? We have kids in the classroom who come in and you know that they don't feel connected. They don't maybe want to be there. Pieces like that. Those are the negative effect sizes that are going to really impact kids. And so to me, it's, yes, I'm a language teacher. And that's what I did. I taught Spanish, but I taught that whole kid that was in front of me, not just the language piece of that kid. So that social emotional piece really supports the ultimate goal of getting the kid to learn the language. And so we always did community connector activities in the classroom. We might do like a mindful minute in the classroom, different like mood check-ins, things like that, where surveys, I did surveys all the time for my students, do quick check-ins. How are they doing? What are they loving about activities? What are activities are they not loving? What could they totally get rid of in the class that they never want to see again? And I just have them do these quick surveys because I needed to know how they were doing and I couldn't make assumptions. And authentically listening to their feedback and then having it impact your actual practice is huge. If kids are given an opportunity to have their voice be heard and they can automatically tell it was never heard, you're done. You've been shut down and they're not going to want to provide that again. So thinking outside language learning, how about that social emotional piece and how that kid is feeling in that classroom?
And you're right. It's so important. So I'm doing a presentation right now about differentiation and the brain. And the brain research is so interesting to me. I mean, we've heard about the affective filter having to do with second language acquisition, but really just the effect of that negative environment on our brains that people just don't understand that our brain will just, it just shuts down. Our reptile part of the brain just says, no, I'm not going to let anything in. I don't feel safe or whatever it might be. And it's not some fluff that we're doing just for fun. It is integral to learning. Right. Yeah. And so that is definitely how can we, and I hope, like, how can we build relationships with students in a real way? Like you said, really ask them what they're interested in, make sure you actually listen and act on that, right? And I think, I don't know, one of the pandemic perks maybe is I do feel like we're talking a lot more about, you know, social emotional learning, connecting with students. And I think, you know, if anything has come out of this, you know, maybe a little bit, you know, we talk, you know, we hear more grace and just things like that. I hope that's something that doesn't go away with, you know, as things move forward, that we're still focusing on building those relationships and, you know, really getting to know those students as human beings, right? Not just passive little vessels that we're going to dump all of our knowledge into.
No, I love that. I love that because a huge, huge low yield strategy that actually has negative effect is boredom when kids are bored in class. And we feel often that it's like, oh, they're just bored because they're teenagers and this and that. But I would always ask myself, what am I teaching them? What does chapter four have that's really engaging my kids, right? And so I'd always have to ask myself, am I pulling in something that's real world authentic to what's happening right now in the world? Even if it was like November 1st and 2nd, Snapchat has a bunch of in the moment streamed videos of Day of the Dead in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So like I need to pull that up on my screen and have kids see what's actually happening right now via platform that they're into to engage them in that conversation, not some pictures in a textbook from 15 years ago. And so I think really asking ourselves, what am I pulling into my classroom that's authentic, that's real, and engages with them? Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, I didn't use a textbook anymore in my classroom. I got rid of it because it was too outdated for my students. I mean, we're talking very outdated, 15, 20 years old textbook.
Right.
No joke. And so they just couldn't connect to it. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge piece. And I always have to ask myself, what are they talking about when they walk in my room? If that's what they're talking about, then that's the language I have to teach them because that's what they want to say. And if I want them to speak Spanish and only Spanish in my room, I got to give them the language that they're wanting to say in obviously an appropriate context.
Sure.
But I think that's huge when we think about what we're teaching kids in the current situation. Don't just do what the next chapter says, because that's what the next chapter says. Ask Absolutely. Yourself what's happening in the world right now, what's happening in their world, and what are they talking about? And I would survey my kids all the time.
Yeah.
What do you guys
I don't know. Right? Yeah, because I don't know, right? I mean, it's getting worse and worse every year, right? So I'm not sure, but you can, thank goodness for Google, because you can literally, you know, ask, you know, like, what are teenagers thinking right now? What are they using? What are they doing? Better yet though, let's ask them, right? Let's ask yep. them and let them be heard and let them teach us something.
Oh my gosh. No, yes.
I mean, that's an important part of, you know, that connection in that community.
I love that you said Google it, because sometimes I'd even go on I would look up Twitter trends, like what's mm-hmm. trending in Twitter right now. Cause I am not hip. Right. I have never expected my students to believe I was. I had to lean on them to know what the heck they wanted to bring into the lesson. Cause And so those are some things I would do. I'd be like, what's trending in places like Twitter and stuff to get an idea of something to bring in. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just, you know, I think about, you know, kind of you mentioned like just outdated things. Like, I don't know how many times I've seen in well-meaning performance assessments that says, you know, like write a letter to X, Y, or Z, right? Yeah. Students aren't writing letters anymore. They're not even writing emails. I talked to Leslie Grant about Gen Z learners and like, that's way too long and way too slow for them. So like we're like email people, you know, Gen X, and they are not, you know, so let them write short texts and how appropriate for novice proficiency, right? It serves kind of two practices. But yeah, I think, you know, let's ask him a little bit, right?
I love that you said the generation thing, because I think that's such a great example for teachers. Cause I think to myself, as someone who's 40 years old, my grandparents, when they talk to me, we have a disconnect. If they were my teacher, I would have a disconnect of what they wanted to teach me and where I was at.
Yeah.
It's the same for our students. And so looking and pulling up a chart, Googling Gen X students and actually just looking at where they're at, I think really helps us as individuals to recognize we're not the same generation.
Yeah. They're not little versions, younger versions of us.
Yeah.
We went through different things. Even I find it fascinating with, you know, just, you know, I'm a Gen X because I was raised by boomers. Right. So, and that was a particular generation. Right. And so my son, who's Gen Z, yeah, who's raised by Gen X. So, you know, it's very, very interesting. And again, like I just tapping into what interests them is so powerful, right? Is there anything else that either has a lot of effect, high effect, or little or not that you wanted to mention before we kind of look at the next thing we're going to talk about?
Well, I think it's maybe going back to kind of pulling all together some of the stuff we talked about already. Because these things have a high yield for learning, when we think about making sure students have a clear idea of where they're headed, like, what am I learning today? Why am I learning this? How will I have learned it? And the teacher being clear on those points. And then they can have an idea of like where they're headed and appropriate feedback. To me, there's nothing wrong with front loading the beginning of your time with kids on teaching them the proficiency rubrics. There's absolutely nothing wrong with taking time for them to engage in it. And I would have my students do this. And if I picked these six strategies as the things all, if I picked six high yield strategies I was going to use for the year and just leaned on those, then I had to ensure I had my kids along with me. And so we would do activities right at the beginning of the year. Give me an example of how to describe a taco at a novice mid, a novice high, and intermediate low. And I needed them to understand what the language was like, because I had to debunk the myth that you're going to become fluent in Spanish by the end of semester two of year one. You're not going to be, nor are you really going to be by probably end of year three. And that's okay, because it's not how the brain works.
Right. And even backwards, you know, we think about like backwards designing and giving those expectations, maybe unit wise or year wise. But I like how you're bringing it in that, you know, for your language learning career, you know, the expectations of what does it take to truly become bilingual, biliterate, you know, what does that take? It's more like you, it's more than year one and two, and it requires X, Y, and Z, right? And so, you know, having their path be transparent to them, we know, but why do we hold on to that knowledge and not share that with them when it is such a powerful tool to get them, you know, to really make an impact on their learning.
I love that you say that. I love that you said, why do we hold on to it? It's kind of like, I think about educators who have administrators who say, I wish my administrator was more transparent. I wish they were more open about things. I don't like when they know stuff and they don't tell me things. And then you feel like the last minute, all of a sudden I'm being asked to do something. Yeah, totally. I'm with you.
It's worse. So,
right? And we say these things, but then we have to ask ourselves, well, what am I doing with my students? It's the exact same flipped version then. Do your students know? Are they with you? Or are you holding this knowledge because for some reason you know and you know the knowledge and for some reason you think you have to keep it? No. Mm-hmm. Spit it out to them. Have them be part of all of it. And this was incredibly important for me for my kids to understand. Like when I talked about classroom discussions, I would tell them right away, okay, guys, your classroom discussion is going to be look at the image on the board and you're going to say vocab back and forth to each other in Spanish of what you see in that image. That's my level ones. That's my novice low, novice mid. And that is an appropriate place for them to be at. But I needed them to know that that was their expectation in that activity. And it was only going to last 30 seconds because that's all I knew they could do. And then they'd switch to a new partner and they would continue doing it. But if not, they're going to feel pressured that they have to speak in Spanish like they would in English. And so all of these things, honestly, is just saying, what are the five goals I have for this year? And how am I going to really nail that quality over quantity in the practice we have? And that's where you got to get rid of all the other stuff that doesn't make sense. And it isn't a high yield strategy. And just really focus on like five high yield.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else you said, I thought was, really interesting. And I lost my thought just like that. Cause I was like, that was brilliant. And then, all right, we'll come back to it. See, this is what happens.
We'll come back.
I'm on the old end of Gen X, I guess. But again, I think absolutely we need to make sure that the whole process is transparent to students and that they know what those, you know, what those expectations are. Oh, I know what it was.
Yes.
When they have realistic expectations of what they're learning and they understand, what do they tend not to do as much? probably Google Translate things, right? Oh, because they know that this is okay. This is where they should be. They should be memorized chunks of language and recombining them in what they perceive to be very uninteresting ways, perhaps, but that's what they need, right? And that, you know, Googling individual words because they're of high interest to you is different than translating an entire paragraph. But, you know, I personally think setting up those realistic expectations proficiency-wise does tend to, you know, kind of get minimize that effect of, you know, the translator and that as well. It's never going to go away because, you know, kids are kids. But people are people.
People are people.
I double check my Spanish if I know this is a professional situation and I want to double check a certain word, you know. I mean, again, a tool versus, you know, a crutch that students use.
I love that you say that because I can't tell you how many times, especially in the virtual realm. I mean, I think about across the nation, anybody who would hear this podcast, some kids are in buildings. Some might be at home still based off the situation of the building. Perhaps the class was quarantined for 2 weeks and they're having to learn virtually again before they can get back in the building. Google Translate is a real thing that will impact our students, especially previously last year. I know kids leaned into it a lot more because they had it at their fingertips. For me, when teachers would say, well, how do you get kids to stop Google Translating? I would say, I show them. If this is where you're supposed to be, explain to me how you produce this.
Right.
And getting them to understand exactly like you said, realistic expectations. This is not my realistic expectation for you. I'm not expecting full three paragraph essay. I'm expecting strings of sentences that are going to be choppy.
Right.
And that's okay.
And not entirely correct.
Oh my gosh. No. Like not at all. And that's where feedback has to be very, very clear. So what I'll say really quick, and then I'll jump to the feedback thing, because I know we talked about that previously, is then having kids be able to understand that my challenging goal for you, my high expectation for you is not a three paragraph essay. It's that you can begin to write strings of sentences. That's your high expectation. And that's it, because that's literally your brain processing language right now. And that's your next step. And it helps them just feel more settled. It fits that social emotional aspect, gets them away from cheating and gets them on the authentic path. So when we think of feedback as a high yield strategy, we have to be very careful as teachers. We cannot take students' work and mark it up past a level that they're expected to be able to produce. I have to ask myself this. What exactly do I want from this kid right now? If my goal is simply strings of sentences and they're trying to connect things and have some connector words, I'm going to focus on that skill that I'm trying to help them with within that proficiency level. I am not going to correct every single verb that's conjugated incorrectly in this piece of work because that's not my expectation for them based off where they should be proficiency-wise. AP students can still conjugate verbs incorrectly and still nail an AP test. And so teachers having a clear expectation of where kids should be at within the work and the feedback they're providing is huge. And I know I get asked this all the time from teachers who are very traditional and grammar, great. That's not working with the brain. If we want rigor, if we want acceleration, we have to do it realistically with the brain, not against the brain. Can't go against the brain because you're not going to get anywhere doing that.
Exactly. And so it, not only is it demotivating, it, you know, takes away from relationships. I have no desire to turn anything else in if I get it back entirely with red checks, right? I'm going to close down. I'm not going to learn. So it's not really effective. Now, is specific error correction effective at some point? Of course.
Yes, of course.
It is. It's not that we, you know, accuracy is important for communication, right?
Yeah.
But it's not just for, yeah. So enough said. But absolutely, I agree. Like, again, that feedback carefully selected, intentional, based on the goals that you have and that your students have for that particular assignment, right?
Yeah, so. And I'll say this really quick because this has been helpful to teachers that I've worked with. Because what I didn't say was I was the world language coordinator for my district for several years. I coordinated all the world language and was the facilitator, like the instructional facilitator for my teachers. And so when it came to feedback, I would tell them, don't correct everything, correct the specific thing you're trying to teach them, but take note to what errors they're making. And then in next day's lesson, work on that with the class. Even if it's something that you haven't really brought up yet, but you're noticing the pattern, bring it into the next day's lesson and the following day's lesson and five lessons down the road in authentic context. You don't even have to like point out the grammar rule that you're trying to get them to fix. Just introduce it over a period of like a week with authentic context, and you're going to begin to realize that unconsciously they're processing it, they're catching it, they're realizing it, and then you can maybe address it down the line. And you might even have a kid, because you're going to have that kid in class. He goes, oh, wait a second. Is that what that's doing in that grant, like in that sentence right there? I get that now. And now the kid's discovered it for you. Yep. So just those pieces, that patience with the brain, processing language, authentic context, that's a better way to do it. We don't have to feel rushed in those areas, because the brain will pick it up in authentic context if we start to expose them to it. And then down the line, point out whatever grammar thing we're trying to get to.
Absolutely. I am a big believer of grammar in context and as a concept. And it's not just like, oh, I believe that. It's that the research supports that, right? Both the research in brain and general education and second language acquisition, right? So fantastic. All right. So any other tips, easy, quick tips of how teachers can implement some of these high leverage teaching practices, like just right away, like tomorrow? What is some easy things that they can work on?
Yeah. I would say if you're on social media at all, if you're on any level of social media, whether it be Twitter, Facebook, whatnot, follow things that are like authentic Spanish organizations. Like I would follow like Burger King, and then I'd follow like the police department in like Mexico, and I would pick different countries and I'd follow different places. So they would be flooding every once in a while. It's like a post from some type of native speaker organization. And I would use those images then in my classroom. And so don't try to feel like you have to hunt for authentic material. Just have it kind of in your everyday realm of things that you're exposed to. Maybe you have Yahoo in Spanish pop up when you on your browser, and you look quickly for like some articles to pull in, some images to pull in. Those were my goal to all the time, that I say to myself, how do I make my job easier? And honestly, I would scroll through Twitter and I would easily be able to find some authentic like images that were great just to pop right into class the next day. And so that's an easy way to bring in authentic material to help some of these areas for your students.
Fantastic. Yeah. You can go down the Pinterest rabbit hole and plan lessons around large chunks of authentic material and scaffold activities and tasks, but you can also just pull up some tweets in the morning as a quick little hook or an opener, or just to make it real to them. Right. And let them see that language in real life. I love that. I love that. I would say so I'm going to kind of transition to the last topic that we were thinking about talking about. We've kind of dug in really deep with that, those high yield strategies. Mm-hmm. I think, again, really thinking about those and really understanding that it's not just for the math teacher and the ELA teacher and the social studies teacher, that it's for all of the content areas. It's for us too. That doesn't mean, you know, we can pull all the best from second language acquisition research and general education research and brain research and really push our students, you know, farther along or walk with them farther along in their path to proficiency. One of the other things I think we talked about is that idea of learning loss, right? And not focusing on that tool. But what should we focus on instead as far as giving that, you know, it's been an unusual year, right? Yeah. It has been crazy. They probably feel like there has been all of this loss. Students are aware, right? Yeah. And they know that this has been not a normal sort of year and a half. So instead of focusing on learning loss, what do you recommend that we do focus on?
Oh, gosh, yes. And I hope teachers never use the term learning loss with kids
in the classroom. I know, right? Ever. Right. Let's get rid of it. I heard one term that was slightly better, and that was unfinished learning. So last year, there was some unfinished learning. And I thought, well, it's better than learning loss. But again, they both still apply that we're going to go back and fill in holes that we're way past. Like, we ran over that road, the holes, we went through them, and let's keep moving forward, right? And that goes back to that acceleration versus remediation. But I still think it's better than learning loss.
Yeah. Well, it's really focusing on everything that we have learned throughout this whole entire process. And I think it's focusing on the fact that we're in a pandemic still. It feels like in some sense that maybe we've reached a lower peak of it, that we've gone up the mountain and we've come down, and we feel like maybe we're working our way down the mountain. We're not totally in the meadow yet, but we're like seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And that's what we hope, right? And then focusing just on the strengths, the things that the kids were able to do strength-wise during the pandemic, and focusing on that. The more that we can lift up a kid and focus on their positives, the resiliency, oh my gosh, resiliency is huge for kiddos. Like, they need to know the things that they have done and achieved throughout this year and a half that can roll into their future and what this means for them. Like, you've made it. You've been resilient. You didn't drop out. You're still here, right? You did complete some work and you did achieve something, and you're here every day with a mask on. What? Right? Like, all these things that we have to do every day, and focusing on that positive. And so it really is focusing on that positive and asking ourselves, how can I say this? There's a term that I've used often with folks called soft bigotry, where sometimes we say to ourselves, where they've been through so much and we can't put more on them, and it's just been too much, and everyone's stressed and everyone's overwhelmed. Yeah, we've been that for a year and a half. If we keep using that as a reason why we don't accelerate and move forward, we're never going to move forward. We will never. And so we really have to ask ourselves, at what point am I saying, yeah, life is hard, life is stressful, together we're going to move forward in this. You're strong, you're resilient, you have overcome so much in a year and a half, and we're going to get you to where you need to get. And sometimes, like, my students would always say to me, they'd be like, this is doing the most. And I'd be like, yeah, to get you the most. I'm going to have these high expectations for you.
Yeah.
And we're going to get through this, and we're going to get there. But at what point are we going to switch our mindset and begin to go back to these habits of rigor and bell-to-bell teaching and all these different things that we need to do in the daily work with our kids? It's now or never. It's not a 6 months from now. It's not a let's get through this year. No,
yeah,
it's now.
No, because
kids can do it.
You're absolutely right. And I think, I don't know about you, there's been so many ups and downs. Like, in the spring, it was like, oh, in the fall, it'll be okay. And then in the fall, now it's like, well, maybe next spring, it'll be okay. We can't just keep, pushing that down, down the road. We do have to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
But I love what you said. Taking the things we've learned, doing better, being more intentional with what we know works and what we know will help students, right? And, like, take those good things, take the persistence, and take those relationships, and take this kind of miserable shared experience and use it for good, right? So connect to, connect the learning to that in certain ways, make it relevant. But focus on what we need to keep moving forward. Right?
And focus on the future for these kiddos.
Yeah.
We have to do that so much. We have to talk about college for some of our high school kiddos and where they want to go and what their next steps are, and keep their mind focused forward, because we feel like we've been in a time warp since
just
March 2020.
It really does. I'm like, I'm like, wait a minute, was that 2 years ago? That, like, was that a year and a half ago?
Right?
Like, it just, like, it's just, we're like stuck in place, right? And not moving forward. And again, that's not necessarily a good emotional place to be, right? We need to keep moving forward. So.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And that's why I would say the only way you're going to get there is by addressing the social emotional needs of your students, but it can't be the only thing we do. And we can't have soft lessons. We still have to have rigor, high expectations, using these high yield strategies, pulling in some social, emotional, mindfulness, mood check-ins, things like that, community connectors in the classroom where you can build that community and move forward. Yeah. It's got to be both. Like you said, you got to think forward and not think we're just stuck here.
And the great thing about teaching languages is that we can do all of that in the target language and give ourselves permission to dig into whatever these sort of, you know, these sort of issues are and do it in the target language and connect all of these other goals that we have.
Awesome. I agree.
Well, this has been a really great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I do, before we go, I'm going to ask you a question that I ask everybody on the podcast. And that is, I've had such a nice time sitting here having coffee and talking with you. If you could sit down and talk to somebody about something, okay, it doesn't have to be education, because I've gotten some great answers, you know, of people wanting to, you know, sit down and talk to, you know, Barack Obama or whoever it might be, Maya Angelou. Who would you talk to? Who would you sit down and really dig into a conversation with? And what would you talk about?
That's so funny. The first thing that jumps in my mind, and this is so random, is Jon Stewart. Because
that would be fun.
I just feel like I'm like when he left the Daily Show, right when we had a presidential change and COVID and all this stuff, I'm like, oh, I could have been entertained by you throughout this whole process and the Daily Show. And I just think he's intellectually insightful, but also funny. So you would have a great intellectual conversation about so many things, but also laugh really hard.
I love that.
And I don't know why that's just the first thing that comes to my mind, probably because people, I mean, I would love to have a conversation with Barack Obama. There's no doubt about that.
I'm too afraid, right? At least, yeah, with Jon Stewart, you'll laugh a lot, right?
Right, well, right.
I think Barack's pretty funny too.
So. I do agree.
Yeah, so that might be a little too intimidating though. So that's a great, I love it. That is a great option. That's why I love this question. I learned so much about people, so. Well, thank you, Alyssa, so much for joining us today. I really appreciate all of your insights and the conversation that we had.
Thank you. No, it was a great time. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great day. Thank you for joining us today in the Language Lounge. If you like what you've heard, please hit that subscribe button to be notified of new episodes. And we'd appreciate it if you'd leave us a review. I'd like to hear what you thought about today's episode. You can reach me on Twitter at LangLoungePod or send me an email at podcast@waysidepublishing.com. Thanks for listening.